说，耶稣说，一个债主有两个人欠他的债，一个欠五十两银子，一个欠五两银子，因为他们无力偿还，债主就开恩免了他们两个人的债。这两个人哪一个更爱他呢？西门回答说，我想是那多得恩免的人。耶稣说，你断得不错。于是转过来向那女人说，向着那女人便对西门说，你看见这女人吗？我进了你的家，你没有给我水洗脚，但这女人用眼泪湿了我的脚，用头发擦干。你没有与我亲嘴，但这女人从我进来的时候就不住地用嘴亲我的脚。你没有用油抹我的头，但这女人用香膏抹我的脚。所以我告诉你，她许多的罪都赦免了，因为她的爱多。但那赦免少的，她的爱就少。于是对那女人说，你的罪赦免了。我们看这一段故事啊，有可以得到很多的教训啊。这里呢告诉我们呢，这个玛利亚就是这个女人啊，就是摩达拉的玛利亚。她这个摩达拉的玛利亚呢，过去呢是受到过这个西门的这个引诱，就是这个法利赛人呢瞧不起这女人，说这女人是个罪人。其实呢，正是她使这个女人犯罪的。这说明有的这种人呢、啊，是可以说是啊内心呢是坏透了，还外表还装了那么一副啊宗教家的这个面孔，还请耶稣吃饭。这个西门呢，过去是长大麻风的，耶稣医治了他。他认为请耶稣吃饭呢，已经是啊，好像是很啊优待耶稣了。哎，结果耶稣说这一番话，使他呢认识到啊自己的罪啊，自己远不如啊那一个他所瞧不起的一个妇女。而且呢，耶稣所讲的比喻呢，就说明啊，这个妇女她是因为她的爱多，所以呢她的罪啊，许多的罪也就赦免了。我们过去常常说什么因信称义是吧，这个说的很多。根据这一个故事呢，根据耶稣这话呢，我们也可以说呢，耶稣要我们怎么因爱称义啊？这个女人呢，就是因爱称义的，是吧？耶稣明明说啊，她爱的多，所以她的罪呢也就赦免了啊。那么我现在呢，就从这个历代愿望啊这里啊读这么一段话，关于玛利亚的。历代愿望571页。玛利亚曾被人看为是一个很大的罪人，但是基督知道那影响他生活的各种环境，他仅可以消灭他心灵中最后一点的希望，就是主啊，如果粗暴地带这个妇女啊，他就会消灭他心中啊最后一点希望。但是他没有这样做，他却把玛利亚从失望和没落之中啊拯救出来。玛利亚曾七次听见他责备那控制他心灵和意念的魔鬼， 他也听见救主为他向天父大声呼求，他知道罪与救主无玷污的纯洁是有冲突的，而他靠着主的力量已经得胜了。当人的眼光看玛利亚似乎没有希望的时候，基督却看他有向善的可能，他看出他品格中的优点，救赎的计划已赋予人类很大的可能性，而这可能性要在玛利亚身上实现出来。借助基督的恩典，他得与上帝的性情有份，那曾经堕落而心中富有鬼魔的人已经啊在这个灵交啊，就是在这个属灵的交往方面和工作上与救主啊接近了。那坐在救主脚前听他教训的乃是玛利亚，那用香膏浇在救主头上并用眼泪洗他脚的也是玛利亚，他曾经守在十字架旁边并一直送救主到安葬之地，在主复活之后头一个到坟墓那里去的是玛利亚，第一个宣传救主复活的也是他。耶稣知道每一个人的环境，你或许要说我有罪而且罪情很重，不错，你固然是个罪人，但你越有罪你就越需要耶稣，他绝不丢弃一个忧伤痛悔的人，他并不将他所能揭露的一切事告诉任何人，只是吩咐每一个战战兢兢的人要刚强壮胆，凡来到他面前祈求饶恕和医治的人，他都愿意白白地广行赦免。基督很可以差遣天上的使者将他愤怒的碗倒在我们这个世界上，毁灭那些对上帝心怀仇恨的人，他很可以将这一个污点，就是这个地，我们这个世界是宇宙中的污点呢、啊，从他的宇宙中除去，但是他并不这样行，他今天仍站在香坛之前，将那一些愿望他帮助之人的祷告呈现到上帝面前。那些以耶稣为避难所的人，他必使他们免受口舌的争闹和控告，没有任何人或恶天使能指摘这些人，基督已把他们与自己兼有的神性人性联合起来了，他们得以站在那背负罪孽的主旁边，并站在那从上帝宝座所发出的荣光之中。谁能控告上帝所拣选的人呢？有上帝称他们为义了。谁能定他们的罪呢？有基督耶稣已经死了，而且从死里复活，现今在上帝的右边，也替我们祈求。我们刚才所研究的路德、以斯帖和玛利亚啊，各有各的难处，但是都是靠主得到胜利。我们也应该学他们。我们可能是像路德一样啊，有我们自己所不能理解的遭遇。为什么我命这么苦？这是路德的他的一生的经历，但是因为他爱主，而且坚定地侍奉主，他最后的结局啊， 是很幸运的，很幸福的。那么另外一个就是以斯帖，这个以斯帖他是一个全国面貌长得最美的一个女子。一般说来啊，这样的姑娘啊是很骄傲的，是吧？我们知道这个撒旦犯罪就是因为他自己长得很美丽，他就为此犯罪了。但是这个姑娘她一点没有这种骄傲的心理，她遇到危险，一般的人认为自己既然蒙这个国王这样子宠爱我到国王面前总不至于遭害吧，国王总得让我见他吧，没有这种想法。他要进食祷告，你们大家为我祷告，为我进食。这个也是一个很好的教训，不要靠自己，你本事再大，你长得再漂亮，你不要以为你能够靠自己得胜，你得胜完全靠主的恩典。那么第三个，这个玛利亚她也是这样，她因为是个罪人，被人瞧不起，但是因为主救了她，她爱主，是而且呢要尽到她最大的努力报答主的恩典，就拿出她最贵重的一瓶香膏浇在耶稣身上。这给我们的一个最好的一个教训就是，我们要学玛利亚一样，要全心全意地归向主，我们一切都是主用他宝血买来的，我们应该乐意地而且出于爱心把自己献给主。
And freed George using a special type of grease. George was not too upset by his experience because the lady who owns the sweet shop heard about his troubles and rewarded him with a large box of chocolates.
Passage 16. Mary had a little lamb. Mary and her husband Dimitri lived in the tiny village of Perahora in southern Greece.One of Mary's prized possessions was a little white lamb which her husband had given her. She kept it tied to a tree in a field during the day and went to fetch it every evening. One evening, however, the lamb was missing. The rope had been cut, so it was obvious that the lamb had been stolen. When Dimitri came in from the fields, his wife told him what had happened. Dimitri at once set out to find the thief.He knew it would not prove difficult in such a small village. After telling several of his friends about the theft, Dimitri found out that his neighbor, Aleko, had suddenly acquired a new lamb. Dimitri immediately went to Aleko's house and angrily accused him of stealing the lamb. He told him he had better return it or he would call the police. Aleko denied taking it and led Dimitri into his backyard.It was true that he had just bought a lamb, he explained, but his lamb was black. Ashamed of having acted so rashly, Dimitri apologized to Aleko for having accused him. While they were talking, it began to rain, and Dimitri stayed in Aleko's house until the rain stopped. When he went outside half an hour later, he was astonished to find that the little black lamb was almost white.Its wool, which had been dyed black, had been washed clean by the rain.
Passage 17. The greatest bridge in the world. Verrazzano, an Italian about whom little is known, sailed into New York Harbor in 1524 and named it Angoulême. He described it as a very agreeable situation, located within two small hills.in the midst of which flowed a great river. Though Verrazzano is by no means considered to be a great explorer, his name will probably remain immortal. For on November the 21st, 1964, the greatest bridge in the world was named after him. The Verrazzano Bridge, which was designed by Othmar Aman, joins Brooklyn to Staten Island. It has a span of 4,260 feet. The bridge is so long that the shape of the earth had to be taken into account by its designer. Two great towers support four huge cables. The towers are built on immense underwater platforms made of steel and concrete. The platforms extend to a depth of over 100 feet under the sea. These alone took 16 months to build. Above the surface of the water, the towers rise to a height of nearly 700 feet. They support the cables from which the bridge has been suspended. Each of the four cables contains 26,108 lengths of wire. It has been estimated that if the bridge were packed with cars, it would still only be carrying a third of its total capacity. However, size and strength are not the only important things about this bridge. Despite its immensity, it is both simple and elegant, fulfilling its designer's dream to create an enormous object drawn as faintly as possible. New Concept English by L.G. Alexander. Developing Skills. Tape 2. Passages. Published and copyright by Longmans Green and Company.
Passage 18. Electric Currents in Modern Art. Modern sculpture rarely surprises us anymore. The idea that modern art can only be seen in museums is mistaken. Even people who take no interest in art cannot have failed to notice examples of modern sculpture on display in public places. Strange forms stand in gardens and outside buildings and shops. We have got quite used to them. Some so-called modern pieces have been on display for nearly 50 years. In spite of this, some people, including myself, were surprised by a recent exhibition of modern sculpture. The first thing I saw when I entered the art gallery was a notice which said, "Do not touch the exhibits. Some of them are dangerous." The objects on display were pieces of moving sculpture, oddly shaped forms that are suspended from the ceiling and move in response to a gust of wind are quite familiar to everybody. These objects, however, were different. Lined up against the wall, there were long, thin wires attached to metal spheres. The spheres had been magnetized and attracted or repelled each other all the time. In the center of the hall, there were a number of tall structures which contained colored lights. These lights flickered continuously like traffic lights which have gone mad. Sparks were emitted from small black boxes, and red lamps flashed on and off angrily. It was rather like an exhibition of prehistoric electronic equipment. These peculiar forms not only seemed designed to shock people emotionally, but to give them electric shocks as well.
Passage 19. A Very Dear Cat. Kidnappers are rarely interested in animals, but they recently took considerable interest in Mrs. Eleanor Ramsey's cat. Mrs. Eleanor Ramsey, a very wealthy old lady, has shared a flat with her cat, Rastus, for a great many years. Rastus leads an orderly life. He usually takes a short walk in the evenings and is always home by 7 o'clock. One evening, however, he failed to arrive. Mrs. Ramsey got very worried. She looked everywhere for him, but could not find him. 3 days after Rastus's disappearance, Mrs. Ramsey received an anonymous letter. The writer stated that Rastus was in safe hands and would be returned immediately if Mrs. Ramsey paid a ransom of £1,000. Mrs. Ramsey was instructed to place the money in a cardboard box and to leave it outside her door. At first, she decided to go to the police, but fearing that she would never see Rastus again, the letter had made that quite clear, she changed her mind. She drew £1,000 from her bank and followed the kidnapper's instructions. The next morning, the box had disappeared, but Mrs. Ramsey was sure that the kidnapper would keep his word. Sure enough, Rastus arrived punctually at 7 o'clock that evening. He looked very well, though he was rather thirsty, for he drank half a bottle of milk. The police were astounded when Mrs. Ramsey told them what she had done. She explained that Rastus was very dear to her. Considering the amount she paid, he was dear in more ways than one.
Passage 20. Pioneer Pilots. In 1908, Lord Northcliffe offered a prize of £1,000 to the first man who would fly across the English Channel. Over a year passed before the first attempt was made. On July the 19th, 1909, in the early morning, Hubert Latham took off from the French coast in his plane, the Antoinette 4. He had travelled only 7 miles across the channel when his engine failed, and he was forced to land on the sea. The Antoinette floated on the water until Latham was picked up by a ship. 2 days later, Louis Bleriot arrived near Calais with a plane called Number 11. Bleriot had been making planes since 1905, and this was his latest model. A week before, he had completed a successful overland flight, during which he covered 26 miles. Latham, however, did not give up easily. He, too, arrived near Calais on the same day with a new Antoinette. It looked as if there would be an exciting race across the channel. Both planes were going to take off on July the 25th. But Latham failed to get up early enough. After making a short test flight at 4:15 a.m., Bleriot set off half an hour later. His great flight lasted 37 minutes. When he landed near Dover, the first person to greet him was a local policeman. Latham made another attempt a week later and got within half a mile of Dover. But he was unlucky again. His engine failed and he landed on the sea for the second time.
Passage 21. Daniel Mendoza. Boxing matches were very popular in England 200 years ago. In those days, boxers fought with bare fists for prize money. Because of this, they were known as prize fighters. However, boxing was very crude, for there were no rules, and a prize fighter could be seriously injured or even killed during a match. One of the most colourful figures in boxing history was Daniel Mendoza, who was born in 1764. The use of gloves was not introduced until 1860, when the Marquess of Queensberry drew up the first set of rules. Though he was technically a prize fighter, Mendoza did much to change crude prize fighting into a sport, for he brought science to the game. In his day, Mendoza enjoyed tremendous popularity. He was adored by rich and poor alike. Mendoza rose to fame swiftly after a boxing match when he was only 14 years old. This attracted the attention of Richard Humphreys, who was then the most eminent boxer in England. He offered to train Mendoza, and his young pupil was quick to learn. In fact, Mendoza soon became so successful that Humphreys turned against him. The two men quarreled bitterly, and it was clear that the argument could only be settled by a fight. A match was held at Stilton, where both men fought for an hour. The public bet a great deal of money on Mendoza, but he was defeated. Mendoza met Humphreys in the ring on a later occasion, and he lost for a second time. It was not until his third match in 1790 that he finally beat Humphreys and became champion of England. Meanwhile, he founded a highly successful academy, and even Lord Byron became one of his pupils. He earned enormous sums of money and was paid as much as £100 for a single appearance. Despite this, he was so extravagant that he was always in debt. After he was defeated by a boxer called Gentleman Jackson, he was quickly forgotten. He was sent to prison for failing to pay his debts and died in poverty in 1836.
Passage 22. By heart. Some plays are so successful that they run for years on end. In many ways, this is unfortunate for the poor actors, who are required to go on repeating the same lines night after night. One would expect them to know their parts by heart and never have cause to falter. Yet this is not always the case. A famous actor in a highly successful play was once cast in the role of an aristocrat who had been imprisoned in the Bastille for 20 years. In the last act, a jailer would always come onto the stage with a letter which he would hand to the prisoner. Even though the noble was expected to read the letter at each performance, he always insisted that it should be written out in full. One night, the jailer decided to play a joke on his colleague to find out if, after so many performances, he had managed to learn the contents of the letter by heart. The curtain went up on the final act of the play and revealed the aristocrat sitting alone behind bars in his dark cell. Just then, the jailer appeared with the precious letter in his hands. He entered the cell and presented the letter to the aristocrat. But the copy he gave him had not been written out in full as usual. It was simply a blank sheet of paper. The jailer looked on eagerly, anxious to see if his fellow actor had at last learnt his lines. The noble stared at the blank sheet of paper for a few seconds. Then, squinting his eyes, he said, "The light is dim. Read the letter to me." And he promptly handed the sheet of paper to the jailer. Finding that he could not remember a word of the letter either, the jailer replied, "The light is indeed dim, sire. I must get my glasses." With this, he hurried off the stage. Much to the aristocrat's amusement, the jailer returned a few moments later with a pair of glasses and the usual copy of the letter, which he proceeded to read to the prisoner.
Passage 23. One man's meat is another man's poison. People become quite illogical when they try to decide what can be eaten and what cannot be eaten. If you lived in the Mediterranean, for instance, you would consider octopus a great delicacy. You would not be able to understand why some people find it repulsive. On the other hand, your stomach would turn at the idea of frying potatoes in animal fat, a normally accepted practice in many northern countries. The sad truth is that most of us have been brought up to eat certain foods, and we stick to them all our lives. No creature has received more praise and abuse than the common garden snail. Cooked in wine, snails are a great luxury in various parts of the world. There are countless people who, ever since their early years, have learnt to associate snails with food. My friend Robert lives in a country where snails are despised. As his flat is in a large town, he has no garden of his own. For years, he has been asking me to collect snails from my garden and take them to him. The idea never appealed to me very much, but one day, after a heavy shower, I happened to be walking in my garden when I noticed a huge number of snails taking a stroll on some of my prized plants. Acting on a sudden impulse, I collected several dozen, put them in a paper bag, and took them to Robert. Robert was delighted to see me, and equally pleased with my little gift. I left the bag in the hall, and Robert and I went into the living room where we talked for a couple of hours. I had forgotten all about the snails when Robert suddenly said that I must stay to dinner. Snails would, of course, be the main dish. I did not fancy the idea, and I reluctantly followed Robert out of the room. To our dismay, we saw that there were snails everywhere. They had escaped from the paper bag and taken complete possession of the hall. I have never been able to look at a snail since then.
Passage 24. A skeleton in the cupboard.
As soon as I went outside, I forgot all about Madame Belinsky because my wife hurried towards me. Where have you been hiding? She asked impatiently. Your sister will be here in less than an hour, and we must be at the station to meet her. We are late already. As she walked away, I followed her out of the fair. Passage 61. Dangerous descent. In future, astronauts will be required to descend from a spaceship while it is still in space and to return to it. The ability to do this will be necessary in future flights to distant planets. Scientists are now trying to discover if this is possible. The spaceship Astra, which left the Earth a short time ago, will be traveling 300 miles into space. At a certain point, the Astra will stop for a short time, and an astronaut will attempt to leave the stationary spaceship and then return to it. We shall not know whether the experiment has been successful until we have received a radio message. The first message is expected to arrive at 7 o'clock this evening. By that time, the Astra will have been flying through space for 17 hours and will have circled the Earth a great many times. When the first radio messages have been received, the results of the trip will be announced immediately.